Thank you, Your Honor. Chris Braddock, Buddy's Christian, 23 Winwood Pond. If you could, I guess a few minutes when it would reach 5 minutes for a vote, I would appreciate it.
Okay.
Juan Carlos Bravo Espinoza was raised in rural Mexico. He went to school through the sixth grade, and he was repeated the first and third grade. He was found to be of normal intelligence for a person of monolingual Hispanic from rural Mexico. In 1999, when he was 14, and after he saw his cousin murdered, he came to the United States. When he got here, he worked in construction as a day laborer, basically. In 2002, he was charged with a sexual assault, very serious case. He was originally charged as an adult in 02 CR 15 and 14, but soon, I guess after a year and a half, they realized that he was a juvenile. The adult case was dismissed, and his juvenile case was, there was a drug file juvenile case. Initially, Mr. Evans, Mr. Shadow, the Coventry County Public Defender, represented Mr. Bravo Espinoza. And during his representation, he was able to secure a plea agreement. And basically, that plea agreement was to plead to return sentence of first degree assault with a potential sentence of 10 to 32 years, as well as pleading guilty to an F5 attempted sex assault.
Counsel, can I stop you for a second?
Yes.
Where in the record does it reflect that Mr. Evans secured or obtained or had this offer of this plea agreement?
Well, first, there's some allusion to it in May 20th of 2003 when Mr. Cabral was initially removed.
What do you mean an allusion to it?
Well, the prosecutor stands up and talks about a plea agreement at that point in time, right at the end of the colloquy with the judge. And then later on in the sentencing on February 24th of 2004, Ms. Bowers lays out what the plea agreement actually was at that point in time.
At the sentencing?
At the sentencing, yes, Your Honor.
After he pled guilty to much later.
After he pled guilty to the new offense of sex assault on a child petitioner.
But there's no draft plea agreement, there's no actual record that he was before the judge on the plea agreement.
There was nothing
that we would consider a real, like you call it an illusion. There's not a real record of this plea agreement being offered and then rejected by Mr. Bravo Espinoza.
Regrettably, no. There was nothing submitted to the court.
Okay.
Really, all we have is just that acknowledgement, one, by the prosecutor that an offer had been made, and two, subsequent to that, at a sentencing, they lay out what the plea agreement actually was for Judge Enzer in arguing for a low-level Department of Correction sentence. What we have here is we have an attorney, Mr. Cabral, who entered on this case, and notably he entered for not much money. He entered without doing anything, making incredible promises, and then eventually ending up not doing anything on the case. In fact, even missing his trial readiness conference. And I think the court found in it, when they removed him, that he wasn't effective. And I don't believe that is, we need to argue that. I think that's plain for the record. Mm-hmm. What we have here, however, is that when the court...
Well, let me stop you again. I'm sorry. Ineffective in what regard? I mean, at that point, okay, he had done nothing on the case, but new counsel was appointed, trial was 6 months later. I can understand the argument that he was ineffective, maybe worse than ineffective, but gave him bad advice by telling him to reject this plea agreement that doesn't really appear in the record, the so-called Evans plea agreement, right? That's a theory.
Yes, the theory of my case is that right. He came in basically, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No,
He came in basically, and without doing anything, without reading anything, without speaking to anybody, advised counsel and convinced Mr. Bravo Espinoza to basically reject this offer and entered in on the case. Then subsequently what happened is that offer was withdrawn. And then what we have is, yes, at some point in time, and I understand that the people's argument is that, hey, wait a minute, new counsel was appointed, and therefore any ineffectiveness must have stopped at that point. But the problem with my argument is that, no, it doesn't stop there.
Well, it doesn't correct the fact that he told him to reject the plea agreement, which was no longer available. That can't be fixed at this point in time. It can't be fixed by new counsel at this point in time, unless you get back to the old plea agreement, which he was not able to do.
Exactly. Right. And so then Ms. Bowers was appointed, and at that point in time, Ms. Bowers really didn't take any. She was ineffective because she did not take any effective measures to try and regain that other plea agreement.
That's my question. What do you base that on? I mean, I assume she's representing the guy. We don't have a record of everything that happened, but she's representing the guy. If she can't get back to the original plea agreement, she would have taken the original. She might have gotten back the original plea, but how is it ineffective assistance to not, you know, to not be able to do that? How is it even relevant to her, or what's before us today?
Well, what we have right now is and obviously it's the absence. It's the absence of anything that was filed by Ms. Bowers as to try and get that record.
What did she have done?
Well, one, she could have filed a motion to enforce the plea agreement, right? And while this is pre-Carmichael, so there was nothing really that in the Colorado case law that had. That had any force, I believe. She did have other things. She had Santabello, she had people from McCrander, which basically says that trying to enforce a plea agreement, you have, it's not just based on principles of contract law, it's also based on the fundamental fairness of due process.
But the plea agreement had not been accepted, it had been rejected.
On that advice. So what we have is we have Mr. Bravo Espinosa's constitutional rights being violated by the first attorney and then the second attorney not pursuing that. And later on she could have filed a motion for 35C for ineffective assistance of counsel when this type of law started to develop.
Prior to accepting the second plea agreement?
After she could have filed a 35C after the acceptance, after he was sentenced, because when you start seeing others in other circuits. Now, notably, it was not here in Colorado, but you start seeing a trend in other circuits where you're looking at, hey, wait a minute, you're supposed to be given effective assistance of counsel during plea negotiations. And so, at the very beginning, at the very start, she could have then turned around and said and filed a motion.
Anything in the record that shows she knew that the earlier agreement had been offered and rejected by Mr. Bravo Espinosa on the bad advice of Mr. Cabral? Anything in the record that shows it?
The only thing that is in the record would have been from the sentencing on May 24th, where she lines it out, and I believe she basically says on May 24th, you know, on the eve of the plea, Mr. Cabral showed up and promised everything, and on advice of Mr. Cabral, the plea agreement was rejected.
It sounds like the perfect storm of ineffective assistance of counsel, one thing on top of another.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Braddock, you say Ms. Bowers could have filed a 35C, but the defendant also had 3 years after sentencing to file a 35C. And I'm having a difficult time understanding, and perhaps you can explain how whatever deficiencies the trial counsel or plea counsel had kept the defendant from filing his own 35C.
Well, I think first you have to look at one. Just the education of the defendant in this case. He was a poorly educated from rural Mexico. He was monolingual. He was not used to this judicial system. And the other thing is that he was being represented by the public defenders. You can see that even after he was sentenced, they filed several motions, mainly motions to correct the illegal sentences, and they took that up to the appellate court. And so he was being represented, and so he, quite honestly, he just didn't know any better. And
Don't we have existing case law that says, though, that the defendant's lack of education or the failure of trial or plea counsel to advise about the availability of post-conviction relief doesn't qualify as justifiable excuse or excusable neglect?
Yes, we do. And I will confess that that is a problem. But what we have here is we also have somebody when you're looking at a circumstance such as this, is where it's due process rights and fundamental fairness is just being trampled, just completely trampled based upon these two errors that we have here, these two significant errors during the course of the case. Additionally, what we have is that with that ineffectiveness, we also have now the discovery at some future point in time, we have the discovery of Mr. Cabral's pattern of praying. And I understand that this is a difficult argument to make, that, hey, wait a minute, how can something that happens when he was sanctioned in 2011, I believe, how can that relate back to when he was first representing Mr. Bravo Espinosa?
In fact, what's the relevance of that? Unless you have a direct tie that part of the disciplinary proceeding had to do with his representation of your client?
Well, the relevance would be the fact that this is a pattern and extends throughout the course of time, and it's something that would not have been disclosed since the disciplinary hearing would have been kind of a secret hearing. Nobody would have known what was going on except what was heard and what was rumored. But in this case, finally, when that disciplinary hearing was, when that opinion was published, everyone could stand up and say, oh, this is what he was doing, and this relates to my case here.
And do you have that
Can you point to that and say that this relates to your case, his disciplinary?
I believe I can. I believe I can because based upon his, based upon what was written in his disciplinary opinion, and based upon what happened in this case, what I found out, what happened in this case, I do believe it relates back, and it shows a pattern as early as 2003 when Mr. Crawl entered on this matter.
So the disciplinary opinion identifies this case as one of them?
No, unfortunately it doesn't. We do have in the record where Judge Ender made some reference about referring to the disciplinary committee, but as far as I can tell, that was never actually done.
Can you have 4.5 minutes left?
Counsel, you might address the sentencing issue argument.
The sentencing argument.
If you want to.
Thank you. What we have here is, in this case, we have Mr. Bravos Mills was sentenced to an indeterminate sentence offense. He was for 16 years to life. And we have several different arguments over the cases that have come out and basically said that this type of sentence, I believe, is not just for somebody who's a juvenile. Specifically, we have Granby, Florida, which says that the juvenile has to have a meaningful opportunity to get paroled.
Can he be paroled after 16 years in this case?
Well,
he may not be, but he could be.
I understand, but the question relates upon, is it a meaningful opportunity for him to make parole after 16 years? And obviously, that's up to the Department of Corrections. And again, without having a hearing, it's difficult to say yes, it exists, no, this it doesn't. My belief is that the programs that are necessary for Mr. Bravo Espinoza to even be eligible for parole do not exist at present day for him to go through to be eligible to be given parole.
The DOC does not have programs in place for these kinds of sex offenders to get parole?
No.
I know a lot of them don't get parole. I think nobody's got parole. Yeah, but
not
programs, but there is a program in place that they could possibly satisfy and get parole.
Not for, my contention is not for monolingual Hispanic sex offenders. That no. I don't believe that program exists in the Department of Corrections.
And your position is if you had a hearing, you would make a showing on this?
I would try. Yes.
As 35 senior?
Yes. That would be what I would be asking for. If there's no more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of the vote.
Very good.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Jacob Loughran, registration number 40904. And I represent the FLE, the people of the state of Colorado. The people request this court affirm the district court's order denying post-conviction relief for two primary reasons. The first is that the defendant's post-conviction relief motion was filed 9 years after he was sentenced without any justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. The second reason is that the defendant pled guilty in this case in case number 03CR3186. Mr. Cabral never represented the defendant in that case. Instead, he represented the defendant in the 02CR1514 case, which was ultimately dismissed because the court lacked jurisdiction to accept any plea in that case. Essentially, and put simply, the 03CR case was a new case with a new attorney and a new plea bargaining process because the court had no jurisdiction to accept a plea in that 02CR case. Going first to the first issue, the time bar. As this court is well aware, a motion for post-conviction relief must be filed within 3 years after a defendant's conviction enters and he is sentenced. Ignorance of the law and misunderstanding of the law and lack of legal assistance do not constitute justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. In this case, the defendant was sentenced on February 24, 2004. For that reason, his time bar expired on February 24, 2007. He did not file a post-conviction relief motion until January of 2013, nearly 6 years after his time bar expired.
Mr. Loughran, as I look at the district court's order, the court did not specifically apply the Wiedemer factors. Is that a problem?
I don't believe that's a problem in this case because the defendant didn't really allege anything to satisfy any of those factors, which for that reason did not really raise the district court's attention to those factors. In this case, all the defendant alleged is that he received ineffective assistance from Mr. Cabral. He received ineffective assistance from his second public defender. And because of that, he was unable to file a post-conviction motion. He never really explains what about their assistance in any way prevented him from filing that motion? Particularly in this case, the defendant, even by his own allegations, was aware in May of 2003 that Cabral was somehow deficient. Yet he never files a motion alleging that Mr. Cabral was deficient, and he never asks his public defender to file that motion. Going a step further on that, all the public defender could have been aware of at that point was that Cabral was deficient in preparing for trial. That's all Judge Enger said when he kicked Mr. Cabral off the case, was you've done nothing to prepare and putting the public defender back on. At that moment, the court had resolved any deficient performance by Mr. Cabral in preparing for trial. He kicked him off the case, reappointed the public defender, and gave the public defender ample time to prepare for trial.
Well, he didn't reinstate the plea bargain offer that Cabral had ineffectively advised him to reject.
That's correct, and there's no problem with that for two reasons, Your Honor. The first is, the public defender, there's nothing in the record that suggests the second public defender was aware that offer had ever been extended. And I understand defense counsel's argument that there's some record on May 20th and some record at sentencing that she knew negotiations had occurred, but nothing suggests she knew a better offer had ever been extended. The second reason that's not a problem is because when she got on the case and the second public defender was appointed, the defendant never told her, Mr. Cabral made me these promises, never told her that he made these promises and never followed through, and certainly never said that he told him that Mr. Cabral told the defendant to reject this offer. Without the defendant providing that information to the second public defender, she had no reason to believe that an ineffective assistance of counsel motion was necessary in this case. Now, as to the defendant's second point that there's newly discovered evidence in this case, it simply doesn't apply. Newly discovered evidence, the standard applies to newly discovered evidence. In this case, we have Mr. Cabral's disciplinary history. That's not newly discovered evidence. It does not undermine confidence in the reliability of the defendant's conviction. It's not material to any of the charges the defendant was facing. And this disciplinary history isn't likely to get the defendant acquittal if his conviction is reversed.
Could you address whether Missouri versus Frye and Lafler versus Cooper should be applied retroactively?
And the answer is no, Your Honor. Both those cases do deal with the ineffective assistance of plea counsel, but they were decided in 2012, and almost every court that's looked at them since, on the state level and on the federal circuit level, or on the federal district court level, have universally said this case does not apply retroactively, primarily because it does not announce a new rule of law. All it did was say Strickland applies to plea negotiations, and defendants had been well aware of Strickland since it was decided. Going a step further on that, here in Colorado, Carmichael was decided in the Court of Appeals in 2007 and the Supreme Court in 2009. So even if, for some reason, this court were concerned that Frye and Lafler applied retroactively, the defendant in this case should have been aware that he had the right to effective assistance in plea negotiations as late as 2009. So he's still time-barred, because he did not file a motion until January 2013. As to the last issue, the sentencing issue that Judge Richman addressed with defense counsel, Miller and Graham simply do not apply to the defendant's sentence in this case. The defendant here was given an indeterminate sentence of 16 years to life.
Can he be paroled after 16 years, or is it impossible, as the other counsel suggested?
There's nothing to suggest it's impossible, Your Honor. It is the possibility of parole, by definition, is what the indeterminate sentence provides for. And there has been some indication that there are people that are being paroled now. And while that's not evident in this record, neither is the fact that no one gets paroled, there have been cases coming forward where a defendant is revoked and is paroled and subsequently revoked and is now appealing that revocation.
But there was a nuance that your counterpart raised. He said that, to his knowledge, there's no evidence of a program in place for monolithic Spanish-speaking inmates. Can you address that?
Monolingual, I think.
Yeah, monolingual. Sorry.
The best answer I can give the court on that is there's nothing in this record that suggests that's true or false, and I don't want to speak without having the knowledge of what is actually out there in the DOC as to that point. But I don't think it really changes the dynamic here, which is the sentence in itself provides that opportunity for parole. And neither Miller nor Graham says that the rarity of parole or the unlikelihood the defendant will be paroled is insufficient. They simply say there has to be an opportunity for parole, which exists here. Whether it's likely to happen or not is another question that is not addressed by Miller or Graham.
Miller and Graham simply look at the sentence on its face.
That,
right? And
that
our case is, the names of which I don't have at my fingertips, the three or four from our court, say, if the age of the, most of the, they deal with the age of the defendant, if the age is such that he could be paroled, that he would reach an age where he could be paroled at some reasonable time.
I believe that's accurate.
It's not illegal. And that's all we have to look at this point.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think the case you're referring to is Lincoln, which specifically, I think in that case, the juvenile defendant got 200 years or something, but he still had a chance for parole when he was 78 or something like that. But that case actually addresses an indeterminate sentence as part of it, and this court has implicitly implied in that case that an indeterminate sentence is not violative of Miller or Graham.
There's a mathematical possibility that he could be paroled. That's not an unlawful sentence. There's a mathematical possibility here that he could be paroled because he only has a 16-year.
Right. He has to serve 16 years, and then he'll be eligible for parole. The last point that the defendant raises in his motion and in his brief is that he should have been granted a hearing in this case. And there are three reasons why a hearing was not appropriate in this case. The first is that nothing in his motion or in his brief alleged that Cabral was, that Cabral's deficient performance in any way prejudiced. As I stated at the outset, Cabral never represented the defendant in the case where he actually pled guilty. He represented him in a case that was ultimately dismissed because the court did not have jurisdiction to accept the plea. Laughlin and Frye do not announce a new rule and are not retroactive, so they do not entitle the defendant to either a hearing or relief, and Miller and Graham simply do not apply to this case because all they barred was a life sentence without parole. The defendant here has an opportunity for parole. His indeterminate sentence, by definition, provides him that opportunity. For these reasons, if there are no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 2 minutes and 38 seconds left.
Thank you.
First, Your Honor, for the sentence and for the potential plea, I would direct to page 5 of the sentencing transcript from February 24th, 2004. That is where Ms. Bowers lies out what the plea agreement was. I do think that that is initial evidence that she knew exactly what the plea agreement was, that it was a much better plea agreement than what she was able to secure. The next point, the Attorney General has stated that it's really kind of a form over substance type of an argument that the 02 case was dismissed and that Mr. Cabral was not in the 03 case. I'd ask the court to discount that. Quite honestly, what we have in this case is it bleeds into one another. And even as the court, the trial court was taking the plea, it used the factual basis that was established in the 02 and the 02 matter that was dismissed to substantiate the plea in the 03 matter. So they both are intertwined. These are not two cases that somehow, once one case is dismissed, it somehow relieves any type of ineffectiveness claims or that was done in the 02 case. With respect to the sentence, and I think that there's an interplay between Laffler and Frye that we have here. First off, what we're all arguing about is a meaningful opportunity, and I think that's what really Graham dictates, is that there has to be some type of meaningful opportunity for parole in this matter. And I'm well aware of the decisions in Lemkew, which basically says that since there was an opportunity for Mr. Lemkew to receive parole at a very late age, that's significantly different than what we have here. What we have here is a straight indeterminate sentence from 16 to life, where there isn't a definitive time when he's going to be able to receive parole.
But that's not because of the sentence, under your theory. It's because of the practices of the DOC, the SOMB, and that sort of thing, isn't it? And that's not been addressed by our cases, as I see it.
That's correct. What we don't know, what is lacking in the record, is what exactly DOC has for the programs and how they offer.
But whatever it is, the sentence itself, isn't the sentence itself that's illegal, it's the parole practices. So maybe it's a constitutional argument, not really a sentencing argument.
I believe, It might be both, but I believe that it still, as applied, it still has to be offer a meaningful opportunity for any type of parole to be to occur.
I don't want to argue, but they can get to the what's the heads of the parole board. You know, what are they? Oh, there's six guys on the five people on the parole board. They don't parole anybody because they're so strict. I mean, that denies a meaningful opportunity? Makes a sense illegal? I find it hard to say we should go that far.
Well, I don't necessarily have to think that we have to look into the parole board's mind, but I do think that there has to be some type of program in place, and that's obviously what I'm contesting is not in place right now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously to look into somebody's mind and try to decide what they're going to do in the future, we can't do that.
All right. But counsel, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused.